407, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead. Well, hello, Todd.
Hello there, John.
All right. Today we have a different type of show. We have a return guest. It's actually part of the show. We use him for sometimes for information. And he's a former Boeing engineer. He's a certified flight test engineer. And lots of experience, worked for the FAA several times. And just an all around good guy. And we use him all the time to help us with getting our data right. And we're going to talk to you today about data. So, Mike, welcome to the show.
And hi, John. Thank you.
And he presently is part of an organization called Kilroy that does certification services for all sorts of people out there. Companies out there that need to certify their aeronautical products. And interestingly, this work that Mike has done on the statistics and safety data dovetails perfectly with the work that Todd used to do at Boeing, because Todd was involved with the Boeing safety annual safety study. So you guys can talk about that. So I'll let you kick it off. Todd.
Well, and once again, reminding people of my own very short career compared to yours at Boeing as a safety engineer. One of the things I did at Boeing was I helped put together, in a very small way, our annual roundup of aviation safety events of larger commercial airplanes. We'd talk about airplanes in the entire world as well. We would have charts and graphs showing the audience back there. Back then, this is so long ago, we actually mailed physical copies around the world, showing how the trend of hull losses per million flights was steadily declining over time. And just to do a little bit of history, back in the 80s, the rate of accidents happening for that generation of large airliners was so high that there were some estimates that if trends continued and there was no reduction in the rate, you'd have a major accident every couple of weeks. And as many of you know, although there have been major accidents in the last few years, it's onesie twosies every few years as opposed to three or four in a year. So yes, the industry, and Mike and I had a very tiny role in that, the industry as a whole moved toward a world where the risk of flights ending up in a bad way is much lower. However, the perception of that risk, that's still something we're dealing with on a whole nother level.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. I agree. The perception of safety. Here's what really gets my attention. An example of this is simply when I was back in the Boston area about 20, maybe more like 30 years ago. The worst accident that had ever happened, the most deaths, was a mid-air collision between a 747 and a Russian freighter. And I happened to read it in the Boston Globe because I got to page 8. And there was the news about it. It wasn't even mentioned on page one, which these things normally go to. However, there were no U.S. citizens who were involved in that accident. And that really accentuates, I think, the fact that perception of safety matters. It's a thing that's actually real. You know, when you miss something, we catch up on something that's on page eight and it's not on the front page, and it's one of the worst accidents in history. That tells a lot. It's very, is something that is incredible.
When I first went to the NTSB, I can remember somebody from the press saying that the accidents sell newspapers.
If it bleeds, it leads.
Yes, and it's really just the advertising dollars that they're looking for, because mm-hmm. they get so many eyes on those pages. Mm-hmm. So it's economical for the newspapers to generate revenue. And we can mm-hmm. see today how many of them have failed because they haven't been able to generate revenue. The advertising dollars now going to the electronic media and not to print, because the young people today don't read the print media. So that's why so many of them get their information from the internet. And unfortunately, all too often, the information that's out there is not accurate. It's either, you know, not complete or way off base.
And that's just a flat out lie.
Right. And that's one of the reasons why we strive so hard to keep the focus on what we do to be as accurate as we can get it. Are we going to make mistakes? I'm sure we will. I'm sure we have. But we try very hard. Now, Todd, I interrupted you. So, Finn.
That's okay. I was reminiscing about days gone by. I started working at Boeing in early 1990s before we even had computers on the desk. Yes, some of you might find it hard to believe, but we had a world where everything was in black and white and we had no computers on the desk. Oh, the black and white part's not true. But in 1994 or so, we actually got computers on the desk, started looking at internet sites back then. They were very crude, not too many of them. But it did get me thinking, hey, you know, this internet thing might go someplace, which is where I started my website back in the day. And 2 weeks after I started my site, I had a whole education about what we've been talking about, what people are attracted to, and what we care about in aviation. This was Flight 800. It happened on July 17th, 1996, 2 weeks after I started my site, and I saw like a 20-fold increase in traffic overnight. Now, I had been of the state of mind of, I'm talking about aviation safety the way we do it in the industry, looking at hull losses as a major measure, that sort of thing, shying away from the things that sell newspapers. But given the response that I saw on day one, I thought to myself, okay, there's an opportunity here to get more eyeballs going on to things like this. But at the same time, how do I remain true to what we all deal with in aviation? That is the facts and data, treating accidents, no matter where they are or who's on them, as the same, since they're all equally relevant for learning opportunities and for informing design in the future and informing operations in the future. And that's something I've balanced ever since. So like John said, we strive to be straight ahead, facts and data. But at the same time, I can't ignore the reality out there. Some of our biggest traffic shows of all time have been accidents. In fact, the Air India accident, I think we had 4 or 5 of the episodes we did that were all in the top 10 of all the years we've done this show, because people are attracted to it.
Mm-hmm.
Again, what do you do with that opportunity? What responsibility do we have in the industry to not abuse that? And, mm-hmm. There might be a few things I do to attract attention, but I'm not going to do anything that's going to be on the edge of being unethical.
Mm-hmm. It's awfully easy to start talking about cause of an accident here. You know, we could, for example, the MB-11 had a porpoising effect. It basically had an accident over around the runway. It would just, nose gear would bounce and bounce and bounce, and it was attributed in many ways to the controls of the MB-11. And people after that accident were just guessing all kinds of crazy things. You know, the Air India thing, I just got into something with a little chat room that I'm involved in, and somebody put out a really nice looking report. They had engineers on it. They had licensed pilots, transport pilots, and they put together the story about what certainly happened. And I got into it and for a request, And I found like four or five things that were absolutely untrue or couldn't be shown. It was too easy, too early to actually show much of anything. And the thing is, it's really easy to do that. It's easy to put something out in the world that is completely untrue. Really, what folks are trying to do is just get attention or get their names known.
Actually, some of that is the source of that technical information is coming from Air India's technical organization. I got a call, and that same report that was put out with that great detail saying that where the zeros and ones could have caused all this problem, meaning the computer glitches could have caused it. And they were trying to get me to sign on to that document. And, it's a multi-page document, a lot of good facts in it, but there's one piece that they don't talk to, and that is the movement of the switch in the cockpit on the pedestal.
Yes.
And that switch has direct to the fuel control, they don't call it the fuel control, but the fuel unit that's on the engine that actually feeds the fuel in the proper ratios into the engine. And there's a valve on the wing spar. So when you turn it off, you turn off the fuel coming from the wing, and you turn off the fuel from this fuel metering device on the engine. And so there's those two valves are driven in an analog circuit, no zeros and ones. Just like you have your switch in your house, you turn the switch and the light goes off and on. Same principle, but there is an additional set of wires on that switch that directly to the flight data recorder. It has its own item on the flight data recorder, that position of the switch. So we know when that switch was turned off, when the engine was turned off, and we by the clock, and we know when it was turned back on, and we know the sequence because there's two switches, and we know the sequence. One was turned off first, and then two was turned off, and the exact same sequence when they turned it back on. Number one was turned back on, number two was turned back on.
Let me ask you something specific about that report. From your readings of it, from both of you reading that report, do you get the sense that this was information that was from, let's say, the Air India Technical Department that was in the open source that someone found? Or was there an inside source you think gave such detailed information? It could not have been an open source. It had to be from inside the organization.
It had to be from inside.
And let me point out something with that. If there was an accident in most countries, US, Africa, it doesn't matter. The company that is involved in the accident, they're not supposed to do anything in the accident investigation that's public without going through the investigative authority. That's not a law. That's a ICAO standard that most countries follow. So if indeed someone from within Air India is leaking information, that would be at cross purposes to how the investigation should play out.
Well, it's not an accident. Once they disclose that happened, it becomes a crime. So now the ball game changes.
Well, that's even worse if you're in a criminal
It's
investigation and you're leaking information not to the police but to the general public. But I'll digress there because I'm sure we'll get some feedback from our audience about any comment we make about Air India.
right. So and let me just clarify why I said so firmly that it had to be an inside source. Because the 787 is the first airplane in essentially of all the airplanes that we have in the world. It is the first product that Boeing totally controls the manuals. The maintenance manual from Boeing is very, very tightly controlled. So they don't give out a manual in every station like they have with all the other airplanes. It's 100% online. You have to be pre-approved to access it, including the machine, usually. So it's very, very difficult for outsiders, including us, to get our hands on information about the 787. Every other airplane, every other accident, you can just get the manuals and you can go through them from one end to the other. There's a lot of information on the web about the manuals, but it's not the official Boeing version. So there is some boil down out there. It's a very, very tightly controlled set of documents. And that document that's floating around that uses 787 material for the sources of their information it's very restrictive. So they, it had to come from somebody who has access to it.
Let me add something to that, sort of going back to the switch positions being recorded. As far as I know, I don't have access to the down detailed data, but as far as I know, there's nothing else that can give a false impression that those switches had been moved. I mean, those switches move. That's the only thing that's going to allow that data to be recorded.
It's exactly one channel. It's an analog circuit, which means it's hardwired, and it's nothing else on that circuit.
Yep. So something happened. And, it's again, patience. We all know we've been involved in these sort of things. All we can do is just wait. But it did bother me, honestly, in the days after that particular accident, that first there was a little bit of talk about the switches being moved, maybe it had to be one of the pilots, and then it sort of went quiet. There were two trails, two avenues of information that were coming out. And that's bothersome. After an accident, again, going back to the folks who just want to get some attention, it's a shame that happens, but it does. And those of us who have been involved in this long enough, we're not going to say a damn thing. We're not going to make any guesses, even though we're all vastly experienced. But part of being experienced is simply knowing when not to talk. I want to go back to the newspaper thing again. I was at an accident site back in Denver. It was a Cessna Caravan that went in, and I went out there with the NTSB guy, and we were walking around the accident center. It was within an hour or so of the time that it happened. And of course, the news was all there. They were behind the tape. They were recording everything. And I got really upset about that whole thing. But also at the same time, it occurred to me that, when we're watching TV or listening to the radio, we think the product is being delivered to us as the customer. But that's not the case. The fact is that we are the product being taken to the folks who are doing the advertising, which has a lot to do with, oh, guess what? There was a really nasty accident yesterday. Here's a brief picture of the flame, and we'll be right back. And then, boom, people are frozen to the screen. And so it's really kind of an interesting thing. It occurred to me as kind of an epiphany. But the truth of that is so, so solid that it bothers me a lot. But it's the way it is. It's always been.
Now, there's one positive thing about that, in a sense, which I didn't realize until I started doing media 25 years ago or so with various channels at the national level. In fact, the very first time I ever had an opportunity to go on national television was Fox News. And Fox News and some, well, that's right-wing media. It's like, look, I'm going to say the same thing no matter who it is. Mm-hmm. Right-wing, left-wing, the airplane flies in this particular way. I'm not going to shade that one way or the other. And as far as I'm concerned, there's no left-wing media. There's no right-wing media. There's only commercial media. Even if it's a, quote, nonprofit media like NPR, they have to satisfy a particular customer base with a particular product. And I'm there to help them do that. Or as I like to tell people, I only have two objectives when I go on radio or television or even on the internet. One, provide useful information. And two, encourage people to stick around past the commercials. If I can do those two things, I've done my job.
Here, here. I think it was Fox some time ago. I've got one of my little articles. They were thinking about buying an airplane and crashing it by remote control. And they made a big noise about it. It might have been like a 747 they were thinking about it. I apologize if that's wrong, but it was definitely being considered by one of the big organizations, one of the big companies that transmit information. And they went to the FAA and wanted to talk about making this happen. The response was a firm no. And somebody went to the FAA PR department and said, why are you not allowing this to happen? And the response was, the FAA is not interested in showing a crash to the public. It was something along those lines. And it was, again, that would have been a really amazing, just an incredible draw for the audience.
Yeah, we did do that 720 out in the desert years ago to test the gel fuel in an effort to try to control the fire in a crash. There was a different formula for jet fuel that had it as in a gel. So when the wing broke open, it wouldn't spread like the fuel did on this recent crash. It would stay sticky and stay together. It's still going to burn, but not as intently, because it's not going to be in the same huge quantity being vaporized.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, the individual who was flying it, he didn't. It wasn't coming in nice and smooth. They sort of got into a little bit of that.
Right.
And the upshot was there was a fire, but the upshot was that they were just saying the guy crashed it wrong.
Yep.
I've never heard of a crash being right.
Now, a very, very small personal aside about that. I was actually a young lieutenant at Edwards where they did the test. And the lead up to that, there was so much security. It's like, oh, you can't go here. You can't be close enough to see it. It's like, even though I was in aviation, that it's like, you know what? There's too much hassle. I'm going to go into L.A. for the weekend. So here I had a chance to see a plane crash, even from a distance. And what do? I go the other way. 40 years later, look where I am now. And by the way, it was referred to, the official designation was the Controlled Impact Demonstration. Now, of course, the young lieutenants gave it another nickname, CID, Crash in the Desert.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
So we wanted to talk about statistics. So why don't we switch to that?
Probably a good idea.
Mike, tell us what you did.
Well, when we were talking about everything that we were doing and what was going on, you mentioned to some folks that I had looked, found some statistics regarding accidents. And I've been using this, you know, the Boeing document for quite some time. You know, Todd, you mentioned that, you were involved in some of these, you know, some of this stuff. And this is back when it was only paper, you know, it was only hard copy that we could get. But every chance I got, I would go get a copy of that thing, because I wanted to keep track of where the world is going, what's going on with the safety world, and how are we improving, what things need to be worked on, and so on and so forth. And this Boeing study went back to 1959, up to the year before the year that it was actually published, you know, so they've gone online now, but of course, so the current version is from 1959 to 2024. And of course, next year will be through 2025 and so on. Turns out that Airbus does the same thing. They have their own web page for that sort of thing. And there are some differences between the two, but I really know that they use the same raw data to build these things. So it's kind of interesting to have those two things and compare them. And really discover how they have, in some cases, a slightly different perspective on the thing. There's also a website called the Lessons Learned from the FAA. The website for that, I'm going to spell it out right now, is that it is www.faa.gov/lessons-learned. And I think there's an underline between lessons and learned, or just Google it. Almost any accident that involves a transport category aircraft or an airliner is going to be included in that. If anybody is thinking about an accident that really jarred them or that really got their attention, they can go there and learn all about it. One of the ground rules inside the FAA was that they would not second guess the NTSB. They would not input their own opinions. What they did was they started with the NTSB report, and they would get a group together, a group of volunteers inside the FAA again, and they would put together a report, and they would actually talk about what it means to the FAA, how it applies to aviation safety, how the FAA approaches it. So it was a really, really nice FAA perspective that's presented on this webpage. I'd recommend anybody who's interested in aviation safety, especially at that level, to go to that website and take a look at it. Later, they wound up adding small airplanes, Part 23, small helicopters, Part 27, and transport category helicopters, Part 29. But those three categories came along quite a bit later, and they're not as filled as the Part 25 transport airplane data. But it's really, really interesting, and there's an awful lot to learn from that.
Who are listening to the audio version of this podcast, the Boeing document, which I should have remembered since I worked on it for years, was a statistical summary of commercial jet airplane accidents. And it looked at the accidents or accident trends from around the world for all sorts of aircraft models, although they excluded those made by the former Soviet Union. But this was like a very basic document that we referred to all the time. back before you had massive amounts of data on the internet. This is one of the few places where you can get process reliable data from an inside source that was publicly available.
Let's clear up one thing for the
Yeah, go ahead,
audience.
John.
Mike just mentioned pot 29, 27, 25. And essentially what that is, it's a chapter in the federal air regulations that deal with specific types of airplanes. So as you mentioned, 29 was helicopters.
Transport helicopters, 27 small helicopters, 23 small airplanes.
Right.
And and it's 14 CFR part 25 and so on. The Airbus version is a statistical analysis of commercial aircraft accidents 1958 to 2024. So they added a year. It's some of the information on these in these two documents is just absolutely startling. I mean, it's obvious that you can see how safety has improved over the decades. It's really, really something.
Improved over the years, safety. Mike, you mentioned it a minute ago about the first generation. For our audience, the first generation, we're talking about the 707s and the DC-8 type airplanes. And then the second generation would be the early 727s. And then the 727-200 would be a second generation. And early 737s fall into that same category. So as the airplanes come on, airplanes stick around in production for upwards of 20 years, sometimes more. And that technology is sort of stagnates. Not, that's not 100% accurate, but it's mostly stagnated. Every time we go to a new generation airplane, we incorporate everything that we've learned from the earlier accidents and put them in the latest ones. And you can actually look, when you look through these statistical analysis, you can actually go through and see the improvements that have come down. And we're now in the fifth generation and moving into the sixth generation of improvements in the fleet. And that every single one of those generational changes has resulted in a much lower accident rate.
With one very notable exception, as we all know about the 737 MAX, it had a couple of fatal events within the first couple of years of operation. And compare that with the 787, which was in operation, what, 13 years before the event happened in India. And the 777, it was in operation for, I believe, much longer than that.
Yeah, it's closer to 20 years.
Like 18 years before it had the first fatal event. So again, the lessons are learned. And for the most part, they're implemented. And what does the future hold? It's going to be less, but will it be an order of magnitude less like we've seen in the last 30 years? Probably not. But still, if you have, let's say, 1,000 aircraft of a particular model flying around for 20 years and there are no fatal events, that would be a good day.
Here, here. I just opened up the Boeing document, and I'm looking at the page that fatal accidents and fatalities by phase of flight. This is kind of an interesting thing. The most of the accidents are either on takeoff and initial climb or final approach and landing. And we're talking about Boeing has 20% for takeoff and initial climb and 47% in the final approach and landing. And it's really, really interesting because those are the transition phases. Those are the phases where things are moving, flaps are moving, gears moving, and so on and so forth. And when you're taking off, especially, then those are the times that if there's a problem with an airplane, it may wind up showing itself at the wrong possible time. Cruise, you're up in cruise, the airplane's cleaned up, it's flying very nicely, and everything's fine. Then you go head back down again. And there's where things are moving again. And, John, your time in the NTSB, why don't you speak to that a little bit? Because it's interesting that I think the total number of fatal accidents in cruise is 10%, which to me is actually kind of a big number. But onboard fatalities was 0% for this entire period.
Yes. Most people don't realize that 92% of what we call aircraft accidents are survivable. Because basically the numbers you just said, 10% on takeoff or 20% on takeoff, Usually those are runway off the runway. So they're not high-speed crashes.
Yes.
Right? So the airplane may or may not be damaged beyond repair, but it's classified as an accident, and oftentimes everybody gets out. Now, we get some injuries going down the slides because people don't listen to the instructions from the flight attendants about how to go down the slides, and they end up getting injured. All right, but they're survivable, which Indeed. Is an important thing. They're survivable. So now, because there's so many survivable, a passenger needs to pay attention to other things. And I'm constantly chiding my seatmates that unbuckle their seatbelts for no reason at all. They don't get up to go to the bathroom. The sign goes off and they unbuckle. And they tell me, don't do that. You leave yourself the seatbelt on. Loosen it up if you're not comfortable with it being tight. But you don't take it off unless you're going to get up. And the same thing holds true with the clothing that we wear. You know, women wear nylons. Nylons that are exposed to high heat melt to your skin. Not a pleasant experience for women. You should be flying. Everybody should be in natural fabric. Should be jeans, to be honest with you, right? To protect you from fire. Same thing with your tops. They shouldn't be nylon. They should be cotton at the very least, right? Just to protect you from that flashover, to give you the couple of extra seconds to get out of the airplane. And all that information is available on the FAA's website. What to wear, what to do, and do everybody well to take a look at that.
While you're evacuating, by the way, leave your bags behind, please. Leave your bags behind. That's one of the worst things that we see quite frequently in videos. I want to add a couple things, by the way, related to this particular subject. One is that a lot of the accidents that are on or near an airport are survivable simply because of the regulations that have come on board the last 20, 30 years regarding cabin safety, especially flammability, crash worthiness, the structure of chairs, seats, and so on and so forth. There's been an incredible reduction in deaths and injuries simply because of that. And the other thing that I want to point out is that reliability plays a big factor as well. You know, in a sense, in my opinion, safety and reliability sort of go hand in hand. I mean, just to state the obvious, an accident is a total lack of reliability. But still, I think as things get more reliable, then safety also benefits from that as well.
No question. The material failures, too. I tell people often, you know, my first accident I was involved with go way, way back. And if Greg was here, he'd be telling you that it was the Wright brothers that I was involved with. But I've been around them for over 60 years. And we don't see the failures for material that we used to. Because every time there's a material failure, like a mix of aluminum, whatever the metal is, or the plastics, or the windows that we use, right? Every time those fail, we analyze the hell out of them. So when the accident's over and you read the NTSB report, that's not the end. There's all sorts of places, obscure places, doing all sorts of research on all the pieces that were involved in that accident and mm-hmm. the things that were uncovered that may not have even caused the accident. I tell the story in my presentations that I give to groups about an accident I did in the 70s in upstate New York, and it was survivable. Everybody survived, but some people got injured. And what bothered me is one of the women that got injured in her head, the big gash, looked just like my grandmother. So I really took that one to heart. But in the course of the investigation, the emergency escape slides, we discovered that they manufactured the material in the slide, and the supporting mechanism for the slide was a high-quality ballistic nylon, we call it today. But it was sewn with cotton thread. And these slides stay on the airplane for 5 years unless there's a problem. And we found that on this airplane that slide would not have worked because of the cotton thread. Before we left that scene, there was a maintenance alert bulletin that went out to everybody that operated those airplanes to physically inspect those airplanes and that those specific slides to see if the cotton thread had deteriorated. And I know at US Air, we found a ton of them that had deteriorated. And I know that American found some too. I never kept track. I didn't have the ability to keep track of it in those days. But that was just one example. That there's hundreds, if not thousands, of those that happened after every single incident. So it didn't cause the accident, had no way contributed to the accident, but it was a deficiency that was noted on that on-scene portion of the investigation, and separately, action was taken to correct it.
And that is how safety works. I mean, that's incredible. You know, Todd, you and I both, with our experience at Boeing, we get into any of these large airplane manufacturers. They have supplier networks that are 5, 6, 7, 8 tiers deep. You know, a nut or a bolt or just the cotton for one of these slides. It can't immediately be seen. The complexity of building and designing an aircraft is just incredible. There's no way Boeing could just run down the street and buy some hardware. They've got to get this supplier network working very well, and it's got to be in a way that communication can be almost instant. And that, you know, that says a lot for our industry, awful lot. I want to just very quickly diverge a little bit. I want to move into commercial rocketry, commercial space. We have regulations that are 14 CFR Part 400, 401, 42, 402, and so on. And a little bit of research on the reliability and safety of rocket launches. The fact is that about 96% of the launches are successful. That leaves 4 or 5% that are not successful. And that means that out of every 20 airplanes that depart Dulles, that one of them is going to go down or just not make it to its destination. And it's okay, by the way. It's okay because people will look at this commercial space industry and say, well, these passengers have just taken their life in their own hands. It's, you know, so it's not a big issue, except it's spectacular and something blows up. But that also takes me back to the early days of aviation when the perception was that people believed that the person up there doing all these tricks in a jetty he was just taking his life into his own hands and good luck and maybe we get to watch it crash, which takes us back to the spectacular nature of the news. I just wanted to make that point because it's amazing that folks will not get too excited about one thing. They get really excited about one crash in a million.
Partially we turn over our care, custody, and control to the airline when we buy a ticket.
Yeah.
We buy a ticket. We're like controlled. We're like a, you know, I don't want to say what first came into my mind, but we're controlled. We're controlled. You heard it. You go down the jetway. You get on the airplane. You picked your seat, but that's your seat. That's you have to. That's where you're going. That's where you're going to sit, and you're going to be there to the end. Somebody else is going to do everything. And so you've given up all that care, custody, and control to the third party, and that has a different flavor to it when it goes bad.
Indeed, the control thing is folks who are fear of flying is it is a control thing. I can't control it, therefore it's got to be bad. I can't do it, and that's okay. You know, there are people who have all kinds of options, all different levels of reactions to flight, but it's there.
And everyone deals with it in their own way. Myself, I don't have a fear of flying. I have an aversion to not knowing what's going on. So how do I deal with that when I'm flying in an airplane? Real simple. Complete deniability of where I am. It's like, okay, I'm not in an airplane flying 8 miles high. I'm in an overcrowded living room with people I don't like, some of whom are passing gas, and I got to sit with them for 4 or 5 hours. But you know, I'll survive this. I'll go to my destination.
Here. There are ways to get even with those folks. You know, I find myself looking for the data plate as I'm passing through the door.
I do that all the time myself.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yep. That's all. It's, one more time, it's something that I can't control. It's just something that I put in my head that maybe helps me a little bit, just with my knowledge that this is where I need to be, and it's okay.
Yeah, I look for the data manufacturer serial number.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Meanwhile, folks behind me are going, come on, hurry up, move along.
Yeah, well, yeah, doesn't mean anything to most people, but it does to us.
I have the internet-enabled way of doing that. I just look for the tail number, and when I sit down, I whip out my computer, go to my my phone, go to my favorite site, airfleets.net, and they have the history of that particular tail number, who owned it before, whether or not it had been in any accident, whether it was like sitting up for years and whatever. So I don't worry so much with airlines in Europe or America, but if I'm in, let's say, the developing world, and I want to know the background of the airplane, I might not do it on the airplane because what I see might make me nervous.
Even though you're stuck.
Might. Well, the reality in our business has always been when the airlines take the life out of the airplane, they sell it to South America or Africa, and they fly for a little bit longer because in the past they didn't have the revenue, the money to buy more modern airplanes. That has changed considerably now. Mm-hmm. And you see in countries like Ethiopia and Egypt and a lot of countries in Middle Africa that are flying brand new airplanes.
Well, this is an opportunity to talk about an ongoing issue with the quality of airplanes and whether they're trustworthy. For the last several years, we've had the war between Ukraine and Russia and the sanctions on Russian airlines. Bottom line, they're not getting the parts, the advice, and the input that they got before sanctions. So the question I have for myself and for everyone else out there in aviation is, would you trust flying on a former Russian airline or aircraft if it got sold and was being flown by your airline? Or would these things be unairworthy and would have to be scrapped?
Boy, going back to the regulations again, 14 CFR Part 3, defines airworthiness conformed to its type design and is in a condition for safe operation. The conformity is a black and white thing. It conforms or it doesn't. You have all the data, you have the airplane right there, and they match up perfectly. That's a yes or a no, period, end of story. Condition for safe operation is a trust kind of thing. Somebody can walk up to an airplane, yep, looks good to me, and somebody else will walk up to it and point out a problem. So the judgment call regarding the safety of an aircraft is really pretty important. It takes somebody who knows his or her stuff to be able to do it. And in my regulations, Part 21, the regulations that tell us the process for approving an airplane design, the word airworthy shows up like 100 times or something. It shows up an awful lot. And that becomes one of the most important words in our regulatory system. Sorry about geeking out here, but this is what it's all about.
Yeah, but you haven't answered the question. Would you fly on a former Russian airliner if it were in the livery of your favorite airline here in the States?
Well, probably not. Although I have to admit, I have to depend on the ability of that particular airline to do the proper work, you know, to make sure that an airplane is airworthy. So that takes a lot of the angst out of that decision. But still, I would kind of think twice. Frankly, I'm not too sure that any reasonable airline would buy one of those airplanes.
They become so expensive to put on the certificate. So we need to explain that. If I'm United Airlines, American Airlines, whatever 121 carrier you want to pick, and I buy an airplane, we have to put it on my certificate. And before you can do that, you have to make that airworthiness determination. So the airline has to make that. And the way they do it is we go in and we do all sorts of maintenance inspections. We open up the airplane. We go in and find out there's a whole list of components on an airplane that are serialized. And it's not 100%, but we have to go in and all the critical systems on the airplane, we have to record what components are in that system by serial number. And then we have to find them and make sure that they've not gone out of time or haven't had an inspection that was due and it wasn't accomplished. It's quite a task. And on big airplanes, it's not uncommon for it to take weeks and weeks to do, depending on how many people you have to do it. Of course, if you come with 50 people, you could probably do it all in a couple of days. But if you come in with four or five people, you're going to spend a month or more doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a the way we operate our airlines is basically a process. The manufacturer has a process that they have to follow to build the airplane. And we're all human beings. Sometimes there's process failures. Same thing with the airlines. The airlines have to have a process. They come to the FAA and says, I want to start an airline, and this is how I am going to operate that airline in order to comply with the rules that you have already in place that I have to follow. So you have to demonstrate to the FAA that you can do all of those things before they'll give you a certificate. And then they monitor you after that to make sure that you're operating within the way that you said you were going to operate. And that's where the misunderstanding comes, because we say the FAA is the policeman. The FAA really isn't a monitor. They come in and make sure that you're doing what you said you were going to do.
Previous show that you did with Sarah McLeod, you talked about how the folks who have the ultimate accountability are the manufacturers and the operators. And there was a Supreme Court decision in 1984 when the FAA was taken to court for not approving, for not guaranteeing the safety of an aircraft. And they wound up saying, they made the point that there are only 400 engineers in the FAA, and they're so far outnumbered that the FAA has discretionary power to look at whatever they need to do. The only thing they can do is do spot checks. The ultimate accountability resides with the manufacturer and the operator. And it's very, very clear. Knowing that bit of information is really, really helpful to anybody who's working in our industry. It's to me, it just opened, it clarified all kinds of questions that I had. Didn't have to worry about it anymore. So the accountability resides not with the FAA, even though the FAA gets publicly beat up for allowing the fox to guard the hen house. That's a political sort of a thing. That's part of the perception of safety. Two things I want to add to what you're just talking about, John. One is MRB. That's manufacturing. Manufacturing repair. Anyway, as an airplane goes down the production line, it could happen that there may be a couple of holes that are supposed to align that don't. And when that happens, the mechanic who's putting the airplane together will stop. He'll make a note of that. The note will then go to the proper individual, who then may or may not carry it to the engineer on the floor. And the decision will be made that either this is okay to, for example, just drill through these holes, and put in a bigger fastener, or if it's a critical place, something else has to be done. There has to be some design work with FAA approval. It happens all the time. And back in the day, airplanes were craft built and everything was paper. And literally each airplane would have like a closet full of paper that would travel with that thing. Once it's delivered, the operators are not going to know that. They're not going to know about all these little things. But they do know that when it was delivered, the airplane was airworthy, being approved to its type design, including those little bits of approvals that are locked away for that specific serial number and in a condition for safe operation. The other thing is that when somebody's inspecting an airplane for import, for example, they have to look at airworthiness directives. And an airworthiness directive is essentially a design change that has to be incorporated by the operator. And it's really easy to pencil whip an AD if you're in an area that where you don't really, you're not being watched over very carefully. And that's something that is very, very critical to the safety of flight. The FAA will only issue an airworthiness directive if there's an unsafe condition related to an issue that's been found. It doesn't have to be an accident. It doesn't have to be an incident. It could be just a maintenance issue. It could be, again, a severe drop in the reliability of something that makes it unsafe. So those two things are pieces of information that you don't necessarily know when you're looking at an airplane for import. You're trying to do an entire conformity of the thing. It could be an inspection that's required on a wing spar, for example, for cracks. And nobody's going to get in there and go all the way down through the wing and take a look at something where the airplane had to be taken apart or a panel had to be removed and replaced. So the system has to be really, really rugged. The system has to just be incredibly tight. And frankly, I'm proud to be a part of it.
And just to clarify, for the Airworthiness Directive AD requirement, the FAA doesn't take a back seat with monitoring that. That one, they eyes on pretty regularly. I've seen them, you know, when we've been doing them, the FAA will show up to see what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And making sure we're doing what we're supposed to be doing. So it's not uncommon that the FAA has a much heightened awareness when the AD notes are being complied with, and they want to see how they're complied with and the rest of it. So there is an ebb and flow to the process between the operator and the airworthiness inspectors at the FAA, where they're not the policemen, they're not standing over your shoulder, but they're not far away. And most people don't know that almost all of the FAA officers, certificate holding officers, the officers that oversee the maintenance for the airlines, in their office, they have a computer connected to the airline's computer system. So they don't have to go out to see what's going on. They don't have to go out to see where the work is being done. They just pipe up, punching in the right codes, and they're going to get all the information that they need. But then it's the physical presence where they walk around, and it looks like they're not doing much, but they've already looked at what they needed to do, and they're just verifying that you're doing what you should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
So the system does work. Does it have holes? You know, I've criticized the FAA for some of the things that they do, and I'm sure they, if they knew everything that I did, they would probably be criticizing me for some of the things that I did. So there is a give and take on that, but given our safety record, it's pretty clear that here in the United States and in Western Europe, that process that we have works pretty well. When we get into other areas of the world, it doesn't always flow as smoothly.
Let me ask you about an emerging area of aviation, advanced air mobility, the buzzword for essentially vertical takeoff and landing, quadcopters and octocopters, etc. How do you think the FAA's oversight capability when it comes to certifying the design and operation of these kinds of technologies, how well do you think it'll work given the realities of the startup companies here and elsewhere who are trying to build a new kind of aviation?
That is a whole new show.
Yeah, yep. But there's one point there. The aviation that we have here in the U.S. was born and grown out of the military aviation program. And I have talked just recently to a couple of FAA people that I know and told me that they are watching, that the people within the FAA are watching very closely what's going on over in Ukraine with drones, mm-hmm. because that's the future operating way we're going to be operating our airplanes. How we launch them, how we recover them, how we maintain them. So they're looking at that very closely to figure out if they're going to, how they can apply some of that knowledge that's been gained over there into our systems over here and elsewhere in the world. So, and another point I'd like to add, that there's a string between all of us ex-government people and ex-manufacturing people that, you know, we all have friends someplace. We all get phone calls. We all get you know, text messages telling us, hey, did you see this? Or, hey, you look, we just found this. So it works well, both the published process and sometimes the corporate knowledge changing hands for the benefit of all.
Now, in Kilroy, we are working actually with a handful of folks, as a matter of fact, and the ones who are having the greatest success are the folks who are actually building these things and using pilots. Basically, they're putting pilots in these aircraft, which then turns it into just another aircraft, although it happens to function differently and it happens to be electrically driven. There's some hybrids out there as well. And they're working through these things. There are some special conditions that have to be put in place simply because of a different type of propulsion and the power systems and so on. I mean, the regulations for engine certification are really just internal combustion type regulations. You know, you have to turn these, you have to run these things for 150 or 200 hours or something like that. And how do you do that with an electric motor that only has like one moving part? How do you make that happen? So, the FAA is struggling with that stuff. However, two of the big leaders, Archer and Joby, they're moving forward with their certification and, they're doing pretty well. On these smaller things, the FAA is trying to come out with, some regulations that, allow these things to be flown, the smaller ones. But what do you do about the 100 pound ones and the 400 pound aircraft that aren't carrying passengers that are being flown autonomously? The military is helping with that as well, by the way, because they have a use for autonomously driven flown aircraft. And it's great not having a pilot because if it gets shot down, you're only losing cargo and there's another one right behind. You know, this whole thing with these vertical lift, rotorcraft, you know, whatever you want to call them, it's the Wild West right now. It's absolutely the Wild West. To me, we can draw a real parallel back to the early days of aviation in the 20s and 30s when everybody had a new design. These folks came up with these new wacky aircraft that maybe flew pretty well. And if they flew pretty well, frequently they'd be bought out by a large company. And eventually things sort of settled down. But there were all kinds of wild, wild aircraft out there, just like we have today. And what's happening now is the beginning days of the great shakeout, is what I call it. And some of these aircraft are just going to just sort of drift away, and some are going to survive and get to be part of the real world. And it will happen. You guys remember the VLJ days, the very light or VLA very light aircraft? It's four passenger airplanes. There was a lot of excitement around it, but it turns out it just sort of winked out for a couple of reasons. First of all, the big giant companies did not necessarily get into it. And to have a commercial rated pilot to haul two or three passengers, it just wasn't economically viable. And what we have now is something that, gosh, I mean, Boeing, Daimler, Toyota, Honda, General Motors, they're all putting money into this new technology. And, they have a 20-year strategy perspective. They work 20, 30, 40 years out. And it's going to happen because these folks will not allow it not to happen. And technology is taking care of a lot of that stuff as well. Technology is moving forward, partially driven by this new industry.
You know what? That's probably a good place for us to stop. And we can carry this on. We'll give you a few days to rest, and we'll get bring you back. Kilroy was here. We'll bring him back. And probably our audience probably doesn't even know Kilroy. Look it up, please.
Yep. Look up Kilroy was here. Go to Wiki.
Yep. So with that, Todd, I'll give you the last word.
Well, my last word is to our audience. As you've probably seen from looking at several shows over the last few months or the last few years, we tend to mix it up a bit. And this is a different kind of show than what we usually do, taking you behind the scenes, as it were. And we could have talked for days about the whys and wherefores of aviation data and the challenges that are faced with not only analyzing the stuff that's out there, but emerging threats out there. That's for another show. So I hope you enjoyed it. And please send your questions, no matter how detailed, because we like to hear the questions and we will give you some answers.
And I'd like to, before I have my last word, I'd like to just remind everybody that this show is brought to you by Avemco Insurance. Great people. I love going up there, watching them deal with their customers, because they are first class dealing with their customers. All right. So please, if you're going to go flying, do a good job of pre-planning your flight, whether here, there, and everywhere in between. Your pre-flight on your airplane, please do a good job. But still find accident reports that the pilots are not doing the right thing. I see it when I'm at the airport. I watch what they do. It's a mixed bag and not good. And once you get flying, put that head on a swivel, because we got an awful lot of brand new pilots out there. And don't become part of their mistake. So please fly safely.
Mm-hmm. We are part of the safest means of mass transportation in history. And I'm really proud to be part of it.
We all are.
Indeed.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetothetexas@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
Avemco Insurance Company has been passionate about aviation safety for over 60 years. That's why they sponsor the FAA's Fast Team Wings program and support I Learned About Flying from That. Avemco even rewards safe pilots with reduced premiums of up to 10%. You can instantly save 5% just for being a Flight Safety Detective's listener. Call 800-338-8705 today or visit Avemco.com/flightsafety and tell them we sent you.